Ali prompts them. The response comes in a chorus. Good morning, Ms. Ali! Ali welcomes them, referring to each class by its new name. The fifth graders are the class of 2015. The sixth are 2014. The number refers to the year in which they'll enter college. Ali then calls upon a group of returning students, distinctive in their white and green kip shirts, to model a line. They place their sneakers precisely along one of the colored stripes painted on the courtyard, eyes forward, hands down, neatly spaced. This is what a line at kip looks like, Ali says, as an assistant translates in Spanish. Does everyone understand? Yes, Ms. Ali, they say as one, catching on. Each child is introduced by name, handed a large three-ring binder, and given a group clap of praise on the beat. Backpacks, water bottles, and coats are left with parents. They need nothing. Kip teachers walk up and down the growing lines, making sure binders are held in the left hand, nice and flat with spine down, that feet are straight, hands are extended, shirts tucked in. Urged to smile, none do. Ali walks the line. She stops at one boy and makes a 20-degree correction in the angle at which he is holding his binder. This is kip culture. It covers how to walk, how to talk. They work on the 3-inch voice, the 12-inch voice, and the room voice. How to sit at a desk, forward, upright, no pencil in hand. How to look at a teacher or classmate who's speaking, called tracking, head up, eyes on them, shoulders toward the speaker. And even how to negotiate the bathroom. Use 4 or 5 sheets of toilet paper, 1 squirt of soap to wash hands. Kip teachers plant trash around the school and see who picks it up. Then celebrate that person in front of the group. They are constantly executing precise routines of clapping, chanting, and walking together. Older students operate under more relaxed rules. They needn't walk in lines, for instance, but even those privileges are earned. Every single detail matters, Feinberg says. Everything they do is connected to everything else around them. After forming lines, the new students are brought into a classroom where they sit on the floor along taped lines. There are no desks because, the students are informed, they haven't earned them yet. The students open their binders to find several pages of math problems. This is silent work time, a morning staple at KIPP. After half an hour of cathedral-like silence, the first few whispers and giggles are hushed by teachers. After that, the quiet takes hold. Ms. Ali strides to the front of the room and welcomes them again by their class names. Our goal, everyone tracking me now, as a team and family, is that every single person in this room is going to college. Ali stops and lets the idea sink in. She repeats the phrase, going to college, with slow and reverent relish, the same way a priest might say, going to heaven. Where are we going? She asks. College, comes the tentative reply. Hand cupped to her ear, Ali feigns deafness. College, they shout louder. Ali smiles, a flash of happiness, then gets serious. I'm going to be straight with you. There are a lot of people who think you can't do it. Because your family doesn't have money, because you're Latino or Vietnamese. But here at KIPP, we believe in you. If you work hard and are nice, you will go to college and have a successful life. You will be extraordinary because here we work really, really hard, and that makes you smart. You will make mistakes. You will mess up. We will too. But you will all have beautiful behavior because everything here at KIPP is earned. Everything is earned. Everything is earned. You're on the floor. Are you uncomfortable? Do you wish you had desks? You will have to earn them. When you can track, then you can clap together. When you can act like KIPP students, then you can have those desks. Ali's dark brown eyes search the room, seeking connections. The students gaze back, nervous, excited, fully awake. To an outsider like me, the level of discipline seems over the top, which is why neighborhood smart alecks call it the Kids in Prison program. But the results are clear. These kids are responding, engaging. We are watching you, Ali continues. Everything here is a test. Everything here is earned. Is that clear? They nod. When I say clear, you say crystal, Ali says. She looks around the room, her eyes glittering expectantly. She tries again. Is that clear? 140 voices say, crystal. If we had to classify the primal cues the KIPP students received in those first few minutes, they would fall into three categories. 1. You belong to a group. 2. Your group is together in a strange and dangerous new world. 3. That new world is shaped like a mountain, with the paradise of college at the top. These three signals might seem unique, but in fact they're identical to the primal cues that any young Brazilian soccer player or Russian tennis player might receive if you replace the word college with the words being Ronaldinho, Kournikova. Bereft of such naturally occurring aspirational figures, KIPP does the next best thing. It creates its own Sao Paulo, a signal-rich world so seamless that it creates new patterns of motivation and behavior. Hence, KIPP's Spielbergian insistence on timing, continuity, and plot. Like Frank Curiel Field in Curaçao, KIPP's physical environs radiate signals. Like a squadron of Tom Sawyers, KIPP's teachers fire cues rapidly and clearly. As Feinberg likes to say, everything is everything. This sounds like New Age palaver, but what he's really talking about is KIPP's insistence on environmental coherency. The way every element of this world, from the painted stripes on the floor to the eyes of the teacher to the angle with which students carry their binders, sends clear, constant signals of belonging and identity. You are at KIPP. You are a KIPPster. Instead of ready, set, go, they say ready, set, KIPP. Students address each other as teammates. KIPP teachers refer to this process only half-jokingly as KIPPnosis. I remember when I came to visit, said Michael Mann, who teaches social studies. I thought it was way extreme. I thought it was ridiculous. I mean, who cares how they hold their binder? But I came to see that attention to detail is a big part of what makes someone academically successful. The rules are ways of getting them to practice being detailed and precise, and that's not something a lot of them have had any experience with. KIPP teachers are not alone in their belief in this tactic. In 2005, psychologists Martin Seligman and Angela Duckworth studied several parameters of 164 eighth graders, including IQ, along with five tests that measured self-discipline. It turned out that self-discipline was twice as accurate as IQ in predicting the students' grade point average. For every year of their lives up to now, the students have been acting in certain ways, Feinberg said. The culture is an incredibly strong force, and the only way to reach them is to change the way they see themselves. It seems intense to somebody visiting, but that's what it takes. One of the ways KIPP creates that change is through a technique it calls stopping the school. This is not fanciful language. When someone violates a significant rule, classes screech to a halt, and teachers and students hold a meeting to discuss what just happened and how to fix it. A few weeks before I visited, the school had stopped because a sixth grader had teased another student, calling her an elephant. The previous stop had happened when a student rolled his eyes at a teacher. By most reasoning, stopping the school when a student teases or rolls their eyes is a gigantic waste of time. And yet it works. KIPP, like a giant link trainer, creates an environment for deep practicing good behavior. Stopping the school for an eye roll is not inefficient. On the contrary, KIPP has found that it's the most efficient way to establish group priorities, locate errors, and build the behavioral circuits that KIPP desires. As you can tell, KIPP's most important signal, its version of an Andrew Jones home run, is college. Or, as it's invariably voiced at KIPP, college! College is the spiritus sancti that is invoked hundreds of times each day, not so much as a place as a glowing ideal. Each homeroom is named after the college the teacher attended. Math classes are in Berkeley, social studies in USC, special education at Cornell Graduate School. KIPP teachers are skilled at slipping references to college into conversation, always with the presumption that all the students are destined for those golden shores. While I visited a social studies class, one student turned in her homework without her name on it. Her teacher's response was to stop the class. "You know how many papers your college professor is going to get?" the teacher asked, radiating incredulity. "You think he's going to take the time to figure out it's yours? Think about that." As English teacher Leslie Eichler said, "We say college as often as people in other schools say, Even the lettering above the classroom mirrors inquires, "Where will you go to college?" KIPP students start visiting colleges as soon as they're enrolled. KIPP Hartwood's fifth graders go to California schools like USC, Stanford, and UCLA, while seventh graders fly to the East Coast to walk the campuses of Yale, Columbia, and Brown, among others. While there, they meet with KIPP alumni who tell of their own journeys. "Right now, college is just a vague idea to them," Ali tells me later, gesturing at the new fifth graders. "But by the end of the fifth grade, after they make a visit, we overhear them talking about it among themselves, saying things like, 'Yeah, I like Berkeley, but I think I'm more of a Cal Poly person.' That's when we know it's clicking." When they get to KIPP, their lives are like a single dot on a map. "You can't do anything with a dot," Feinberg said. "But when they connect that dot to another dot, to a college somewhere, then you get a connection. When they get back from those trips, they carry themselves differently." This simple, powerful idea is made real in Lolita Jackson's math class. Jackson, who's in her late 50s, is a small woman who wears gigantic earrings and radiates galvanic discipline and enthusiasm. She spent the first 20 years of her career working in the local public school system, increasingly frustrated by its limitations. When KIPP Hartwood came along, however, she joined up and quickly rose to become one of its most effective teachers, as well as its assistant principal. Ali regards Jackson's skills as near magical. "Ms. Jackson does things that nobody else can do," Ali says simply. For instance, each year after orientation week is finished, Jackson begins her first math class by clicking off the lights and asking students to close their eyes. She slips a Star Wars soundtrack into the CD player and turns it up. As the triumphal music surges, Jackson strides around the room as if she were the captain of a rocket ship on countdown. "You buckled up, Kippsters?" she asks. "You ready? You strapped in good and tight? Because this is going to be a bumpy ride. It's going to be tough, and it's going to be hard, but it's also going to be great, because we are going to work and learn some math, and we are going to college." The kids sit quietly, the music resounding in their heads. "College," Jackson repeats, tasting the word. "Do you want to know the difference between a good life and a hard life? You want to know the difference between having the knowledge and power to get the things you want and not having that knowledge? Fasten your seatbelts, because that's where you are going, starting right now." Like Spartak, Meadowmount, and the other talent hotbeds, KIPP Hartwood is a bastion of deep practice. Jackson and her colleagues constantly remind KIPP students that their brains are muscles. The more they work them, the smarter they will get. And there's plenty of work to do. 2 hours of homework a night is standard. Worksheets number in the hundreds. The day is filled with stretches of intense, silent work. As Feinberg said, softer methods might work in other schools, but we literally don't have any hours to waste, much less days or weeks. Our kids arrive way behind. We need to get them up to speed and ahead. It's like the fourth quarter of a football game. We're down by a touchdown, and we've got to get downfield and score now. The touchdowns are happening. In 2007, KIPP Hartwood students ranked in the top 3% of California public schools, according to the state's standardized testing and reporting program. What's striking in the end, however, is not how hard KIPP students work, but rather how swiftly and completely they take on the KIPP identity that provides the fuel for that hard work. On both of my visits, I was approached by KIPP students who wanted to know how I was doing, if there was anything they might do for me, and, of course, where I went to college. Some of these exchanges felt a bit scripted, the overly firm handshakes, the fervently agreeable nodding, the geisha-level politeness, but beneath the artifice vibrated the sincere effort of someone stretching toward a new persona. "I like it here a lot," said Daniel Magana, a crew-cut sixth grader. There's no special treatment for anybody. At my old school, they let me slide. I could do 5 out of 10 things and nobody cared. Here I do 10 out of 10. Daniel, whose father is a construction worker, plans to be the first member of his family to attend college. He's not so sure which college yet. He's going to consider the California system. It's so much cheaper, you know. And he needs a pretty big school, one that offers a double major in his desired fields of laser surgery and creative writing. So he's thinking Berkeley. But that could change, he said sagely. We'll see. When I asked Daniel to tell me what he was like back before he enrolled in KIPP, he looked gravely to the tile floor, as if peering into an ancient archaeological dig. Different, he said finally. I think I didn't really like school. It was boring. At my old school, I used 25% of my brain, but here I use 100%. Ancient history didn't hold his interest long, however, and soon Daniel raced off on new tangents, inquiring about the ages of my kids and recommending books for them, asking about my travels, and then checking the clock and saying, "Sorry, nice talking with you, but he'd better get to English class. Handshake. Goodbye." And I'm left standing with a question. Who exactly is this kid? How much of Daniel is Daniel, and how much is a result of his experience at KIPP? There's no way to say whether Daniel Magana would have been an ambitious, considerate, high-achieving kid had he not attended KIPP. Perhaps he would have been the same, or perhaps once he graduates from KIPP, he'll revert to old patterns. But as I watch him disappear into the crowd, I'm struck by how KIPP alters our instinctive notion of character. Usually, we think of character as deep and unchanging, an innate quality that flows outward, showing itself through behavior. KIPP shows that character might be more like a skill, ignited by certain signals and honed through deep practice. Seen this way, KIPP stands on a foundation of myelin. Every time a KIPP student imagines himself in college, a surge of energy is created, not unlike that created in South Korea when girls imagine themselves to be Sayri Park. Every time a KIPP student forces himself to obey one of these persnickety rules, a circuit is fired, insulated, and strengthened. Impulse control, after all, is a circuit like any other. Every time the entire school screeches to a halt to fix misbehavior, skills are being built as surely as they were when Clarissa did her start-stop attack on Golden Wedding. No wonder Daniel Magana is such a polite, well-disciplined young man. He has been ignited to deep practice those qualities. What we do here is like lighting a switch, Ali said. It's extremely deliberate. It's not random. There's no chance involved. You have to stand behind what you do to make sure every single detail is pushing the same way. Then it clicks. The kids get it. And when it starts, the rest of them get it too. It's contagious. Part 3. Master Coaching. Chapter 8. The Talent Whisperers. It's not about recognizing talent, whatever the hell that is. I've never tried to go out and find someone who's talented. First, you work on fundamentals, and pretty soon you find out where things are going. Robert Lansdorp, tennis coach of former world number one players Pete Sampras, Tracy Austin, and Lindsay Davenport, all of whom grew up within a few miles of each other in Los Angeles. The ESP of Hans Jensen. In the early part of the 20th century, American bank robbers weren't very skilled. Gangs like the Newton brothers of Texas followed a simple and unvarying plan. They picked a bank, waited until nightfall, then blew open the vault with dynamite and or nitroglycerin, which, in addition to being ticklish to handle, occasionally had the unfortunate side effect of setting the money on fire. This straightforward approach worked well for a time. But by the early 1920s, the banks had caught up, introducing alarm systems and concrete-reinforced blast-proof vaults. Gangs like the Newtons were stymied. Bank authorities expected that a new era of safety and security had dawned. It didn't dawn. The bank robbers simply became more skilled. These new thieves worked in daylight and operated with such clockwork professionalism that even the police were occasionally moved to admiration. It was as if bank robbers had suddenly evolved into a more talented species. they demonstrated their capabilities in downtown Denver on December 19, 1922, when a gang relieved the Federal Mint of $200,000 in 90 seconds flat, a feat that then ranked on a per-second basis among history's most lucrative bank heists. This evolution could be traced to the man who led that Denver gang, Herman the Baron Lamb. Lamb was the originator and teacher of modern bank robbing skill. Born in Germany around 1880, Lamb rose to become an officer in the Prussian army. Expelled from the army, allegedly for cheating at cards, he emigrated to the United States, where he took up a semi-successful career as a hold-up man, robbing people and occasionally banks. In 1917, while serving a 2-year stint in Utah State Prison, Lamb conceived of a new system of bank robbery, applying military principles to what had been an artless profession. His singular insight was that robbing banks was not about guts or guns. It was about technique. Each bank job involved weeks of preparatory work. Lamb pioneered casing, which meant visiting the bank, sketching blueprint-like maps, and occasionally posing as a journalist to get a look at the bank's interior operations. Lamb assigned each man on his team a well-defined role: lookout, lobby man, vault man, driver. He organized rehearsals, using warehouses to stand in for the bank. He insisted on unyielding obedience to the clock. When the allotted time expired, the gang would depart, whether or not they had the money. Lamb scouted the getaway route in different weather conditions to gauge time. He taped maps to the dashboard that were indexed to the tenth of a mile. Lamb's system, dubbed the Baron Lamb technique, worked well. From 1919 to 1930, it brought Lamb hundreds of thousands of dollars from banks around the country. After his death, it was taught to John Dillinger, among others. Lamb's system, still employed today, succeeded not only because of its conceptual strength, but also because Lamb was able to communicate his ideas and translate them into the seamless performance of an immensely difficult task. He was an innovator who taught with discipline and exactitude. He inspired through information. In short, Baron Lamb was a master coach. So far in this book, we've talked about skill as a cellular process that grows through deep practice. We've seen how ignition supplies the unconscious energy for that growth. Now it's time to meet the rare people who have the uncanny knack for combining those forces to grow talent in others. Before we find out who the master coaches are, however, let's find out who they aren't. When most of us think of a master coach, we think of a great leader, a person of steadfast vision, battle-tested savvy, and commanding eloquence. Like a ship's captain or a preacher on the pulpit, their core ability lies in knowing a special something that the rest of us don't, and sharing that special knowledge with us in a motivating way. In this way of thinking, the skills of legendary football coach Vince Lombardi are not appreciably different from those of General George Patton or Queen Elizabeth I. But when I visited the talent hotbeds, I didn't find many Lombardis or Pattons or Queen Elizabeths, for that matter. Instead, the teachers and coaches I met were quiet, even reserved. They were mostly older. Many had been teaching 30 or 40 years. They possessed the same sort of gaze, steady, deep, unblinking. They listened far more than they talked. They seemed allergic to giving pep talks or inspiring speeches. They spent most of their time offering small, targeted, highly specific adjustments. They had an extraordinary sensitivity to the person they were teaching, customizing each message to each student's personality. After meeting a dozen of these people, I started to suspect that they were all secretly related. They were talent whisperers. They were people like Hans Jensen. Hans Jensen is a cello teacher who lives in Chicago. I met him at Meadowmount Music School, that remote haven of classical talent in the Adirondacks we visited earlier in the book. I'd never heard of Jensen, but here, even amidst an all-star faculty, he was regarded as special. During my first morning at Meadowmount, two students mentioned how their families had relocated to Chicago so they could take lessons from Jensen. Melissa Kraut, who teaches at the Cleveland Institute of Music, simply described him as the most brilliant cello teacher on the planet. Jensen turned out to be a rangy, ebullient, 50-ish Dane with large round glasses, from behind which he regarded the world with the voracious gaze of a scuba diver. When I found him in one of Meadowmount's practice cabins, that gaze was aimed at 18-year-old Sang Yi, who was playing a Dvorak concerto. To my ear, Sang's playing was miraculous, fast, clean, note-perfect. But Jensen was not satisfied. He stood a few inches away as the student played, waving his arms and talking to Sang in his thick Danish accent. It looked as if Jensen were performing some kind of exorcism.
"Now! Now!" he shouted. "There is only now! You gotta go, wah, like a turban. You gotta do it, man, and you gotta do it now!"
Sang played furiously, his hand flashing up and down the neck of the cello. Jensen leaned in closer.
"I see it in your eyes. You say, 'Oh, crap, I have to do it.' So don't think,"
pronounced sink in Jensen's accent.
"Do it, now!"
Sang closed his eyes and played.
"Yeah, yeah," Jensen shouted. "Go, go!"
Sang ended the piece and leaned back woozily, as if he had just stepped off a carnival ride.
"There," Jensen said. "That is where you have to go with this."
Sang thanked Jensen, packed up his cello, and departed as Whitney Delphus, the next student, stepped forward. Delphus was 20 years old, from Houston, and wore a pink Lacoste shirt with a collar turned up. She had arrived in time to see the end of Sang's lesson, and now took her seat, grasping the neck of her instrument, sweating lightly. Jensen put her at ease, leaning back in his chair, smiling broadly.
"Howdy," he said disarmingly.
Delphus smiled and seemed to relax a little. Jensen asked her to play, and he listened quietly as she dove into a Bach concerto. Delphus was shakier than Sang. She smudged a few notes, lost the rhythm of a fast passage, and generally seemed to be wrestling with the instrument. She glanced warily at Jensen as she played, expecting him to launch into another arm-waving, shouting exhibition, as he had with Sang. But Jensen didn't. After 30 seconds, he placed a gentle hand on her bow, stilling it. He leaned in, as if he were about to whisper a state secret.
"You must sink it," he said.
"Sink it?" Delphus was mystified. Jensen tapped his bald head, and she understood.
"Sink," he repeated. "Sink the whole piece. When you sink it, it is 10 times better. People practice too much, moving the bow. You must practice up here."
He pointed again to his head.
"You must sink. This is the vitamin. It doesn't taste good, but it's good for you."
Delphos set down her bow, closed her eyes, and as instructed, imagined her way through sections of her concerto. When she was finished, her eyes open again, Jensen said, "You used vibrato when you imagined playing that last section, didn't you?" Delphus's jaw dropped.
"How did you know?"
Jensen smiled. "I sometimes freak people out," he said. "They think I have ESP. Jensen has a long list of professional qualifications. He studied at Juilliard with renowned teachers Leonard Rose and Channing Robbins. He has soloed with the Copenhagen Symphony and won the Artist International Competition. His knowledge of classical cello music is second to none. But what we're seeing here has nothing to do with Jensen's qualifications, and everything to do with his mysterious ESP. Specifically, his skill at sensing the student's needs, and instantly producing the right signal to meet those needs. Jensen did not know Sang and Delphus before they stepped into the room. He didn't need to. The examination, diagnosis, and prescription all happened within seconds. Sang needed more emotion, so Jensen turned into a hepped-up cheerleader. Delphus needed a learning strategy, so Jensen turned into a Zen master. He didn't only tell them what to do. He became what they should do, communicating the goal with gesture, tone, rhythm, and gaze. The signals were targeted, concise, unmissable, and accurate. After Jensen was finished teaching Sang and Delphus, I asked him for his professional opinion of the two students. Which was more talented? Which had more potential? Jensen seemed to struggle with the question, which surprised me. Sang seemed better than Delphus by a decent margin. But the planet's best cello teacher didn't see things the same way I did.
It's difficult to say, Jensen said evenly. When I teach, I give everyone everything. What happens after that, who can know? This sentiment, even-keeled, prudent, unromantic, had a familiar ring. Many of the talent whisperers reminded me of my relatives in Illinois farming towns, who were tough, unsurprisable, and circumspect. They could talk for hours about the tiniest details of seeds or fertilizers, but when it came to the larger questions, the quality of the upcoming harvest, the playoff chances of their beloved St. Louis Cardinals baseball team, they shrugged. Who can know? Master coaches aren't like heads of state. They aren't like captains who steer us across the unmarked sea or preachers on a pulpit ringing out the good news. Their personality, their core skill circuit, is to be more like farmers, careful, deliberate cultivators of myelin, like Hans Jensen. They're down-to-earth and disciplined. They possess vast, deep frameworks of knowledge, which they apply to the steady, incremental work of growing skill circuits, which they ultimately don't control. Jensen couldn't answer my question, because at its heart, the question didn't make sense. Is it possible to look at two seedlings and tell which will grow taller? The only answer is, it's early, and they're both growing. The Wizard's Secret. In 1970, two educational psychologists named Ron Gallimore and Roland Tharp were given a dream opportunity to set up from scratch an experimental reading program at a laboratory school in a poor neighborhood in Honolulu. The project, which was funded by a Hawaiian educational foundation, involved 120 K-3 students and was dubbed the Kamehameha Early Education Project, or KEEP. Starting in 1972, when the school's doors opened, Gallimore and Tharp applied the most cutting-edge pedagogical theories of the day, many of which had to do with teacher strategies to increase the percentage of on-task time. Gallimore and Tharp were innovative, hard-working, and determined. They also weren't very successful. For the first 2 years, reading achievement at KEEP remained low. By the summer of 1974, Gallimore recalled, "We were starting to seriously question our methodology." That summer happened to find both Gallimore and Tharp at UCLA, where they taught a few classes and puzzled over their stalled-out project. One afternoon, while shooting baskets in Gallimore's backyard, Gallimore had an idea. They would perform a detailed, up-close case study of the greatest teacher they could find and use the results to help them at KEEP. Both men instantly thought of the same teacher, who happened to be right on UCLA's campus. Yet they hesitated. This particular teacher was so brilliant and acclaimed that to ask him to be a lab rat in a study seemed unthinkable, if not insolent. But Gallimore and Tharp, with nothing to lose, decided to write the famous teacher anyway. They mailed their request to his office in Pauley Pavilion, addressed to Mr. John Wooden, head basketball coach. To describe John Wooden as a good basketball coach is like describing Abraham Lincoln as a solid congressman. The Wizard of Westwood, as Wooden was known, was a former English teacher from small-town Indiana who quoted Wordsworth and lived Christian values of discipline, morality, and teamwork. He had led UCLA to 9 national championships in the previous 10 years. His team had recently concluded an 88-game undefeated stretch that had lasted for nearly 3 years, one of the many historic feats that would later lead ESPN to name Wooden the greatest coach of all time in any sport. As Gallimore and Tharp were well aware, Wooden had no earthly reason to submit himself to the prying of a couple of nosy scientists. So they were more than a little surprised when Wooden's answer arrived. Yes. A few weeks later, Gallimore and Tharp settled eagerly into courtside seats at Pauley Pavilion to watch Wooden coach the season's first practice. As fans of the team, as well as former athletes themselves, they knew what to expect. Chalk talks, inspiring speeches, punishment laps for slackers, praise for hard workers. Then practice began. Wooden didn't give speeches. He didn't do chalk talks. He didn't dole out punishment laps or praise. In all, he didn't sound or act like any coach they'd ever encountered. "We thought we knew what coaching was," Gallimore said. "Our expectations were completely wrong. Completely. All the stuff I'd associated with coaching, there was none of it." Wooden ran an intense whirligig of 5 to 15 minute drills, issuing a rapid-fire stream of words all the while. the interesting part was the content of those words. As their subsequent article, Basketball's John Wooden, What a Coach Can Teach a Teacher, put it, Wooden's teaching utterances or comments were short, punctuated, and numerous. There were no lectures, no extended harangues. He rarely spoke longer than 20 seconds. Here are some of Wooden's more long-winded speeches. Take the ball softly. You're receiving a pass, not intercepting it. Do some dribbling between shots. Crisp passes, really snap them. Good, Richard. That's just what I want. Hard, driving, quick steps. Gallimore and Tharp were confused. They'd expected to find a basketball Moses intoning sermons from the mount. Yet this man resembled a busy telegraph operator. They felt slightly deflated. This was great coaching? Gallimore and Tharp kept attending practices. As weeks and months went by, an ember of insight began to glow. It came partly from watching the team improve, rising from third in the conference at midseason to winning its 10th national championship. But it came mostly from the data they collected in their notebooks. Gallimore and Tharp recorded and coded 2,326 discrete acts of teaching. Of them, a mere 6.9% were compliments. Only 6.6% were expressions of displeasure. But 75% were pure information. What to do, how to do it, when to intensify an activity. One of Wooden's most frequent forms of teaching was a three-part instruction where he modeled the right way to do something, showed the incorrect way, and then remodeled the right way, a sequence that appeared in Gallimore and Tharp's notes as M+, M-, M+. It happened so often, they named it a Wooden. As Gallimore and Tharp wrote, Wooden's demonstrations rarely take longer than 3 seconds, but are of such clarity that they leave an image in memory much like a textbook sketch. The information didn't slow down the practice. To the contrary, Wooden combined it with something he called mental and emotional conditioning, which basically amounted to everyone running harder than they did in games all the time. As former player Bill Walton said, practices at UCLA were nonstop, electric, supercharged, intense, demanding. While Wooden's practices looked natural and unplanned, in fact, they were anything but. The coach would spend 2 hours each morning with his assistants planning that day's practice, then write out the minute-by-minute schedule on 3x5 cards. He kept cards from year to year so he could compare and adjust. No detail was too small to be considered. Wooden famously began each year by showing players how to put on their socks to minimize the chance of blisters. What looked like a flowing, improvised series of drills was in fact as well-structured as a libretto. What looked like Wooden shooting from the hip was in fact closer to planned talking points. As Gallimore and Tharp wrote, Wooden made decisions on the fly at a pace equal to his players in response to the details of his players' actions. Yet his teaching was in no sense ad hoc. Down to the specific words he used, his planning included specific goals both for team and for individuals. Thus, he could pack into a practice a rich basketball curriculum and deliver information at precisely the moments it would help his students learn the most. Gradually a picture came into focus. What made Wooden a great coach wasn't praise, wasn't denunciation, and certainly wasn't pep talks. His skill resided in the Gatling gun rattle of targeted information he fired at his players. This, not that. Here, not there. His words and gestures served as short, sharp impulses that showed his players the correct way to do something. He was seeing and fixing errors. He was honing circuits. He was a virtuoso of deep practice. A one-man link trainer. Wooden may not have known about myelin, but like all master coaches, he had a deep understanding of how it worked. He taught in chunks, using what he called the whole part method. He would teach players an entire move, then break it down to work on its elemental actions. He formulated laws of learning, which might be retitled laws of myelin: explanation, demonstration, imitation, correction, and repetition. Don't look for the big, quick improvement. Seek the small improvement one day at a time. That's the only way it happens. And when it happens, it lasts, he wrote in The Wisdom of Wooden. The importance of repetition until automaticity cannot be overstated, he said, in You Haven't Taught Until They've Learned, authored by Gallimore and former wooden player Sven Nader. Repetition is the key to learning. Most people regard Wooden's success as a product of his humble, thoughtful, inspiring character. But Gallimore and Tharp showed that his success was a result less of his character than of his error-centered, well-planned, information-rich practices. In fact, it was Wooden's commitment to this method of learning that led him to agree to participate in Gallimore and Tharp's experiment in the first place. As Wooden later explained, he had hoped to use the experience to improve shortcomings in his coaching. The wizard's secret, it turned out, was the same secret that the Renaissance artists and the Z-Boys discovered. The deeper you practice, the better you get. Gallimore and Tharp returned to Keep that fall and began to apply what they'd learned, placing a new focus on lesson planning and information-oriented teaching. They combined praise with Wooden's. They demonstrated and explained. They spoke in short imperative bursts. They also added other new research, including a mix of cultural-based approaches. We refocused our work, Gallimore said. We started approaching the school with the idea of, what would John Wooden do? Slowly, steadily, Keep began to take off. Reading scores rose, comprehension improved, and the school, which had previously lagged far behind national averages in standardized test scores, was soon exceeding them by a healthy margin. In 1993, Gallimore and Tharp's Keep project received the Grohmeyer Award, one of education's highest honors. Their success was chronicled in their book, Rousing Minds to Life. It's not so simple as to say John Wooden made the school work. There were lots of dimensions to this, Gallimore said, but he does deserve a lot of the credit. Even as we point out Wooden's coaching brilliance, however, it's important to note that he was hardly operating under average circumstances. His players arrived at UCLA with high degrees of skill and motivation. He had vast resources on which to draw. But what about coaches and teachers who live in the normal world? What kind of coaching works best in situations where students are starting out, where they haven't been selected for any special ability, where the circuitry doesn't yet exist? Or to put the question in terms that matter around our house, what makes for a good piano teacher? Coaching love. It's the most basic common sense. If you want to start a child in a new skill, you should search out the best-trained, most John Wooden-like teacher possible, right? Not necessarily. In the early 1980s, a University of Chicago team of researchers, led by Dr. Benjamin Bloom, undertook a study of 120 world-class pianists, swimmers, tennis champions, mathematicians, neurologists, and sculptors. Bloom's team examined each along a range of dimensions, among which was their initial education in their chosen field. They discovered a surprising fact. Many world-class talents, particularly in piano, swimming, and tennis, start out with seemingly average teachers. For instance, Bloom's researchers asked the piano virtuosos to rate their first teacher as very good, defined as a highly regarded professional instructor with extensive training, better than average, a teacher with good training and more musical knowledge than a local neighborhood teacher, or average, a non-professional neighborhood teacher. Of the 21 internationally accomplished pianists in the study, only two had a first teacher who qualified as very good. The majority had teachers who qualified as average, 62%, or better than average, 24%. The pattern held in swimming and tennis. The neurologists and mathematicians typically received their first training in school, which wasn't subject to the same variable of teacher choice, while the sculptors had not been guided by early instruction of any kind. One might suspect that the average teacher was quickly replaced with someone more skilled, but that didn't seem to be the case. Bloom's pianists, for instance, had typically stayed with the first teacher for 5 or 6 years. From a scientific perspective, it was as if the researchers had traced the lineage of the world's most beautiful swans back to a scruffy flock of barnyard chickens. As the study concisely put it, the initial teachers were largely determined by the chances of proximity and availability. Chance? But aren't Wooden, Jensen, Preobrazhenskaya, and the other talent whisperers successful because their skills represent the precise opposite of chance? At first glance, Bloom's study would seem to suggest that top-flight talent is an innate genetic gift that transcends teaching. But perhaps something else is going on here. As it happens, the town in which our family lives, population 5,000, is a bit of a musical hotbed. Long winters don't hurt. There are several top-flight teachers with impressive degrees from top institutions and a spanking new music school. But when my wife and I decided to start our kids at piano lessons, we were directed toward someone we didn't expect, a little old lady who taught in a rickety house built around a trailer that stands next to a creek. Her name is Mary Epperson. Mary Epperson is 86 years old and 4 feet 6 inches tall. She has thick white hair and keen dark eyes that seem custom-built to express curiosity and wonderment. Her voice is musical, able to stretch single words into brief songs of delight or conspiratorial whispers. She does not engage in small talk, but rather holds previous conversations in her mind like so many threads, which she operates with sharp tugs. She begins most conversations with the phrase, "Now tell me." If you are a child visiting Miss Mary for a lesson, this is what happens. First, she is extremely pleased to see you. She lights up like a Christmas tree. You talk a while about what's happening in your life and hers. She remembers all of it, of course, the camping trip, the English test, the new bike. She nods gravely at the serious points, laughs at the funny ones. She regards children as miniature adults and doesn't shy away from pointed truths. Once Miss Mary asked my father if he ever played an instrument. He said he had tried piano, but didn't have the knack. "Didn't have the patience, you mean," Miss Mary replied kindly, but firmly. The lesson begins. By most measures, it's the usual routine. Songs are played, mistakes are made, improvements are suggested, stickers are pasted to tops of pages. But on a deeper level, something entirely different is happening. Each interaction vibrates with Miss Mary's interest and emotion. To have better hand position is to earn a thrilling jolt of praise. To play something incorrectly brings a regretful, "I'm sorry," and a request to please play it again, and again, and perhaps again. To play something properly brings a warm gust of joy. When it's over, there's a foil-wrapped chocolate. Then you bow and say, "Thank you for teaching," and Miss Mary bows and solemnly replies, "Thank you for learning." I thought of Miss Mary when I read the descriptions of the so-called average first piano teachers in Bloom's study. She was really great with young kids. She was very kindly, very nice. She liked young people, and she was very nice, and he liked her. He was very good with kids, liked kids instinctively, and had a good rapport. He was enormously patient and not very pushy. She carried a big basket of Hershey bars and gold stars for the music, and I was crazy about this lady. It was an event for me to go to my lessons. These people are not average teachers. Neither is Mary Epperson. As Bloom and his researchers realized, they are merely disguised as average because their crucial skill does not show up on conventional measures of teaching ability. They succeed because they are tapping into the second element of the talent code, ignition. They are creating and sustaining motivation. They are teaching love. As Bloom's study summed up, the effect of this first phase of learning seemed to be to get the learner involved, captivated, hooked, and to get the learner to need and want more information and expertise. It is not easy to love playing the piano. It has lots of keys, and a child has lots of fingers, and there are an infinite number of mistakes that can be made. Yet, certain teachers have the rare ability to make it desirable and fun. As Bloom's study put it, perhaps the major quality of these teachers was that they made the initial learning very pleasant and rewarding. Much of the introduction to the field was as playful activity, and the learning at the beginning of this stage was much like a game. These teachers gave much positive reinforcement, and only rarely were critical of the child. However, they did set standards and expected the child to make progress, although this was largely done with approval and praise. If Gallimore and Tharp were to conduct a study inside Miss Mary's tiny studio, they would find a stream of cues rich enough to rival those given on the Poly Pavilion basketball court. This is not an accident. John Wooden uses the deep practice part of the talent mechanism, speaking the language of information and correction, honing circuitry. Miss Mary, on the other hand, deals in matters of ignition, using emotional triggers to fill fuel tanks with love and motivation. They succeed because building myelin circuits requires both deep practice and ignition. They succeed because they are mirrors of the talent code itself. Yet while myelin may be counted in reps and hours, Wooden and Miss Mary also show us that master coaching is something more evanescent, more art than science. It exists in the space between two people, in the warm, messy game of language, gesture, and expression. To better understand how this process works, let's pull back and take a broader look at the shared characteristics of master coaches. Chapter 9, The Teaching Circuit, A Blueprint. A teacher affects eternity. He can never tell where his influence stops. Henry Brooks Adams. The Four Virtues of Master Coaches. Great teaching is a skill like any other. It only looks like magic. In fact, it is a combination of skills, a set of myelinated circuits built through deep practice. Ron Gallimore, who is now a distinguished professor emeritus at UCLA, has a good way of describing the skill. Great teachers focus on what the student is saying or doing, he says, and are able, by being so focused and by their deep knowledge of the subject matter, to see and recognize the inarticulate stumbling, fumbling effort of the student who's reaching toward mastery, and then connect to them with a targeted message. The key words of this sentence are knowledge, recognize, and connect. What Gallimore is saying, and what Jensen, Wooden, and Miss Mary are showing, links back to our thesis. Skill is insulation that wraps neural circuits and grows according to certain signals. In the most literal sense, master coaches are the human delivery system for the signals that fuel and direct the growth of a given skill circuit, telling it with great clarity to fire here and not here. Coaching is a long, intimate conversation, a series of signals and responses that move toward a shared goal. A coach's true skill consists not in some universally applicable wisdom that he can communicate to all, but rather in the supple ability to locate the sweet spot on the edge of each individual student's ability and to send the right signals to help the student reach toward the right goal over and over. As with any complex skill, it's really a combination of several different qualities, what I have called the four virtues. The matrix, the first virtue. The coaches and teachers I met at the talent hotbeds were mostly older. More than half were in their 60s or 70s. All had spent decades, usually several, intensively learning how to coach. This is not a coincidence. In fact, it's a prerequisite, because it builds the neural superstructure that is the most essential part of their skills. Their matrix. Matrix is Gallimore's word for the vast grid of task-specific knowledge that distinguishes the best teachers and allows them to creatively and effectively respond to a student's efforts. Gallimore explains it this way. A great teacher has the capacity to always take it deeper, to see the learning the student is capable of, and to go there. It keeps going deeper and deeper because the teacher can think about the material in so many different ways, and because there's an endless number of connections they can make. Or, as I would put it, years of work go into myelinating a master coach's circuitry, which is a mysterious amalgam of technical knowledge, strategy, experience, and practiced instinct, ready to be put to instant use to locate and understand where the students are and where they need to go. In short, the matrix is a master coach's killer application. We'll see how the matrix functions in a moment. For now, the point is that people are not born with this depth of knowledge. It's something they grow over time through the same combination of ignition and deep practice as any other skill. One does not become a master coach by accident. Many of the coaches I met shared a similar biographical arc. They had once been promising talents in their respective fields, but failed and tried to figure out why. A good example is Louisiana-born Linda Septian, who eventually founded the Septian Vocal Studio in Dallas, Texas. Septian is a tanned, youthful 54-year-old who tends toward skin-tight tracksuits and metallic sneakers, and who possesses a natural exuberance that allows her to move past obstacles that would discourage most people. This exuberance shows itself in the way she talks, quickly, candidly, italicizing key words, and drives her BMW. Only 17 speeding tickets last year, she informs me. But also in her approach to the ups and downs of life. During our first conversation at her studio, she mentioned that her house had caught fire last year. How big a fire? I asked. I wasn't there, but my neighbors said there were some pretty big explosions when the boat blew up, she said. It took 6 fire engines to put it out. I lost everything. My piano, passport, clothing, photos, toothbrush, all burned up. My cockatoo Cleo got singed, but she made it. I didn't mind losing my stuff, but I minded losing the time. That's what's precious to me. I've had to move like 6 times in the last year while we built a new place. So that isn't any fun. But you know what? Septine gave me a frank, dazzling smile. I like the new house better. I really do. Septian has had some practice rebuilding. In her early 20s, she had a successful opera singing career, performing with the New Orleans Symphony Orchestra, and a marriage to a famous football player, Dallas Cowboys place kicker Raphael Septian. But when she was in her late 20s, her opera career stalled out, and her marriage did likewise. In 1984, pregnant with her first child, on the verge of separating from her husband, she went to Nashville with the idea of making a transition to popular music and recording a Christian album. She auditioned with a team of record producers, singing, "I Am a Miracle, Lord." The audition went well, or so she thought. "I sang beautifully. I hit every note," she remembered. And when it was finished, the producers sat there silently. "I thought, I've stunned them. They know I'm great." Septian smiled ruefully. Then they told me the truth. I was terrible, awful. They didn't care about notes, they cared about feeling, and I sang with no feeling, no passion, no story. I was a classical singer. I had no idea how to sell a song. I can't tell you how much this bothered me. I thought I was really, really good, really talented, and here were some guys who said flat out that I sucked. And they were right. I did stink. It made me really mad, and it also made me really curious. I wanted to figure out how to do this. Septian spent the next few months taking care of her new baby and studying big pop and rock acts. Tom Jones, the Rolling Stones, U2. She studied the way they sang, moved, and spoke. She took notes, scribbling on napkins and programs, tucking her findings into large 3-ring binders. Septian approached pop music like a medical student, systematically dissecting its various systems. How did Tom Jones manage his breathing in Delilah? How did Bono use movement to convey emotion in his songs? What made Willie Nelson's minimalist vocals so compelling? She watched audiences as much as artists to see what really turned them on. Despite all this work, Septian's singing career failed to lift off over the next few years. She made ends meet by selling real estate, working as a spokesperson, modeling, and on occasion teaching classical voice lessons out of her home. "It wasn't like I was a good teacher," she said. "I was the only ad for voice in the Dallas Yellow Pages." When youthful acts like Debbie Gibson and Tiffany succeeded in the early 1990s, Septian saw a growing trickle of kids who wanted to be pop stars. I said, "Why not? I knew pop music. I just had to figure out how to teach it." At first, Septian taught pop the same way she'd learned classical, by teaching students to follow universal principles of technique. But that didn't work. "Really quickly, I switched and became more artist-focused," she said. "I realized my job was to find out what worked for somebody and connect it to what worked in pop music. There was no system for doing that, so I had to invent my own." Septian dug into her binders and over the next few years created a curriculum that applied the rigor and structure of classical training to the world of pop. She mined Whitney Houston vocals for scale exercises. She developed programs for diaphragm exercises, ear training, and scat singing. Like Feinberg and Levin at KIPP, she was constantly experimenting with new approaches, discarding, trying again. She made performing a central element, arranging gigs for her students at malls, schools, and rodeos. She required students to write their own songs, importing professional songwriters to teach them how. Over the years, the matrix of her knowledge expanded. That expansion accelerated in 1991 when an 11-year-old named Jessica Simpson showed up at Septian Studio for a lesson. She sang Amazing Grace, Septian recalled. Jessica had an infectious personality, real sweet, but she was painfully shy on stage. Plus, her voice needed a lot of work. It was beautiful, but it was churchy, which made sense because her dad was a minister. She had a big vibrato, Septian demonstrates, filling her office with pulsating sound. You can't sing pop music with a vibrato. You ever seen a pair of vocal cords? They're pink and shaped like a V. They're muscles, basically. The vibrato meant that